that tonight is sickness, illness, and Buddhist practice, illness and mindfulness practice. And I thought I would say a few words, talk a little bit my reflections on the topic, and then just open it up, and maybe we can hear from some of you, some of your comments based on what I said, or your own experiences of the interface between a spiritual practice and illness. Part of the inspiration for this topic was my being sick last week. You know, in the scheme of things, it wasn't such a bad sickness, but it was a very powerful kind of laryngitis, where I had lots of fever and I lost my voice and a sore throat and became, I don't know if I became exactly delirious, but I couldn't really think straight. And I had almost no motivation to do anything. And it was quite dramatic because I knew I should be drinking a lot. And my wife would bring me water and I would drink a sip. And then I just couldn't do it anymore. I couldn't drink. I didn't have the energy or the interest anymore. I just put it down. And you know, an hour, 2 hours later, she'd come by and say, "You've been drinking." And, no. And so to kind of be in an altered state of mind while being sick and be so radically, at least for 3 or 4 days, have my life turned upside down and just be in bed and being sick. Maybe think about sickness and maybe think a lot about my sister, who's often quite a bit sicker than I am. I mean, she has chronic sick illness. And I kind of understood her much better because she needs to drink a lot. She has a kidney transplant. And when she gets sick, it's very serious if she doesn't drink. And a year ago, she was hospitalized for dehydration. And I understood a little bit better why it's so hard for her to take care of herself with drinking when she was really sick, because I just couldn't get the motivation to do it. And then also today, I listened to a tape, a Dharma talk, by Suzuki Roshi, who was one of the more pioneering, important Zen masters to bring Zen to America. And in this Dharma talk, he starts off straight off by saying, in his Japanese English, he says something like, "Sickness does not destroy people. No practice destroys people." And then he chuckled. And periodically through this talk on sickness, he chuckled. And this was a year, he had less than a year to live, and he'd been quite sick the last year or so before he gave this talk. So he was very familiar with sickness and being old, and it was lovely to know that, and to hear him talking about sickness and then chuckling, chuckling on himself. Sickness does not destroy a person. Not practicing destroys a person. I thought that was a very powerful statement. So what is it to be destroyed by sickness, and what is it that a practice does? Why is it that not practicing is really what destroys a person? What is it that a practice saves us from when we're sick, when we're ill? That's the interesting question. I learned some kind of simple things about illness when I was at Tassajara, when I was during my monastic life, and I was doing a lot of practice. One of the things I learned, because of the amount of meditation I was doing perhaps, was when I got sick, was the very direct connection between my mind and my body. And maybe a lot of people discover this when they're sick. And I would notice, I remember once being really sick with a cold, or a flu or something, and I had to work anyway because of the situation required my assistance, my help. And so I was working away, and I was really tired and really feverishy and whatever. And I noticed that I had to watch my mind really carefully, because if I had thoughts of self-pity or any kind of negative kind of thoughts in my mind, my energy level would drop. And if I didn't have those thoughts and thought basically kind of sound wholesome thoughts, that my energy wouldn't rise to great, to great, you know, states of health. But I wouldn't be dragged down by this draining of energy that came with my thoughts. And I was really struck by this, by what a dramatic effect my thoughts had on my energy level, my energy state. And most of us, I think most of the time, have enough energy, have kind of a robust kind of energy, that we don't necessarily see the effect that our thoughts have on the whole system. And sometimes when we're really sick, we can see that. Some years later, my back went out, and I noticed the same thing then, that my back was so out that I could barely kind of walk, and there was such a dramatic influence between my thinking and the state of my back that I had to watch my mind in order to be able to manage to kind of get through the day with my bad back. And again, most of us, our health is so good that we don't have to have that kind of sensitivity, the relationship between the mind and the body. But I think that people who meditate, who become familiar with their minds, with their thinking, their reactions, the way their emotions respond to their inner and outer life, develop familiarity with the whole territory or terrain that becomes extremely useful when you get sick. One of the things I noticed when I was in the monastery at Tassajara was when people got sick there, a high proportion of the students there would feel really guilty. It was as if they had this work ethic that if they weren't working, they were, you know, inconsequential, they were unworthy, they were something. And this was a Buddhist monastery where what kind of work has to happen in a monastery, you know, just, you ring a bell. So, you know, and this isn't that consequential. Maybe if you're one of the cooks, you know, it's important to kind of, but they can assign someone else to the kitchen if you're sick. But I was really struck by, and what happens often in the monastery is certain tendencies we have that are maybe not so clearly seen in normal life get highlighted in the kind of isolated environment of a monastery. And I saw during the time I was there a lot of guilt that people felt because they were missing out on work. They're only a worthwhile person if they're working. And so it becomes interesting to look at the kind of relationships and judgments we have about our illnesses and sicknesses when they arise. Is there a sense of guilt? Is there a sense of failure that might arise? Sometimes when people get sick, there's a kind of a self-blaming that happens. I must have done something bad. I'm a terrible person. I've heard this kind of idea of karma, and you know, it's my karma to get sick, and you know, I must have done something really awful. You know, I must have had the wrong kind of mental set, mindset, or something. And so people in a sick situation sometimes will turn around that information of being sick to attack themselves, to blame themselves. Another part of judgment or a thing that affects us when we get sick is the idea that it's somehow wrong for people to take care of us. It's something wrong. It's something wrong with us if we're in a dependent relationship now, that other people get to do things for us. We can't do anything on our own. We have to call some friends to take us to the doctor or do shopping or, you know, make meals for us, bring us water, tell us to drink. And if we kind of have the expectation that we're supposed to always be self-reliant and standing on our own two feet, it can be quite a drain on us to be sick and not be able to do that. So the first thing of Buddhist meditation practice can help with is this thing about seeing the relationship between the mind and the body. And in seeing the relationship between the mind and the body, starting to take care of them in a more better way. Take care of them through meditation practice, or if you're in bed just lying there. It doesn't have to be formal meditation. It can simply be watching your responses and reactions and seeing how you can keep the body relaxed and at ease, and not getting caught up in fears and aversions that come into place because of our judgments about being sick. One of the things I do when I'm sick is, if I'm well enough to it, I try to meditate. I try to sit up in meditation. But rather than doing a lot of mindfulness when I'm sick, I tend to do a concentration practice where I try to get myself as relaxed as possible. And often it takes the form of scanning through my body and looking for wherever the tensions are in the body when I'm sick. And usually when I'm sick, there are tensions in different places in my body. And I'll just focus on relaxing those places of tension, if I'm well enough to be able to do that. Or if I can't sit up and meditate, then I'll do the same thing lying down, trying to keep the body relaxed, keep my breathing relaxed. And also pay attention to my mind for the example of what I told you about the judgments and all that. Is it possible to be present in a state of sickness without judgment, without aversion, without fear? So those are the two main kind of practical things I tend to do when I'm sick, is to try to keep my body relaxed, try to develop some states of concentration or calm in my body, in my mind, and look at all the reactions in my mind, and to see if I can let go of them and not be held under the sway of the various judgments and fears I might have. Now, some people expect, occasionally you find people who expect a spiritual practice is supposed to cure them of their illness. If they're sick for something, if only I can figure out the right meditation practice or the right kind of spiritual thing to do or the right mantra or whatever, I should be able to zap the illness away. Illness is one of the kind of basic elements, basic features of human life. We all get sick at some point. And some people get sick quite chronic illnesses. Some people die of their sicknesses and illnesses that come along. I told my sister this afternoon that I was going to give a talk about sickness, and I asked her if she had any thoughts about what I could talk about, what I could say. And she said a few things about when people are really chronically sick, it's really useful to listen to them and let them kind of tell you their difficulties and let them even complain about, you know, going to doctors and all. Just listen to them, she said. And so she asked me, why are you going to do this? Why are you going to give a talk on sickness? And I said, oh, because I had this cold last week. And she started laughing. She started laughing. She thought that was really funny. I think she was like, you know, just a little cold. But there are some times when no amount of practice can really make any serious impact on our illness. When in the worst of my laryngitis or whatever I had, not only couldn't I drink water, but I couldn't muster my mind up, you know, enough to be able to do any kind of practice. I couldn't really focus on, you know, on anything. I was just kind of laying there, kind of in la la land. And so whatever I had thought, you know, I could do in a healthier situation in terms of practicing and relaxing the body and focusing on my breath or focusing on my reactions and thoughts, it just wasn't possible in those states. And I know there are situations where people get very, very ill, and there's very little anymore that you can depend on. You can help you to support you. Sometimes friends aren't even helpful. So what is spiritual practice then? And I think it's very important to realize that the function of spiritual practice is not to cure us of our illnesses. It can be very helpful. It can be very helpful, and it might actually help kind of bring on healing of an illness. But I think it's kind of a false promise. I know it's a false promise that any kind of promise that a spiritual practice is going to be the ultimate cure for any kind of illness. I believe that what Buddhist spirituality can offer is potentially a few things. One is we can learn how to replace aversion and fear with compassion and awareness. And for me, that's one of the definitions of healing of the heart. Is not, you know, we can heal the heart maybe in some sense easier than we can heal the body. And maybe the body will end up dying. But what causes kind of spiritual illness when we are sick tends to be the fear and the aversion that tends to arise. And there's many different forms of fear and aversion. And spiritual practice, like mindfulness, is meant to be an antidote to fear and aversion. And learning, teaching us slowly how to replace fear and aversion with compassion and awareness. Compassion is maybe one of the most important qualities that anybody develops in a spiritual life. Probably it's the most useful thing to develop, a sense of compassion. Compassion includes a sense of acceptance of the suffering, of the difficulty a person's in, and not to be in, to have the primary relationship to oneself or to someone else who's sick, that of compassion, which is kind of a sense of caring, of nurturing, of acceptance of the person. Have that to be the primary relationship, as opposed to a relationship of demanding something to be a certain way, or afraid that it's going to end up a certain way, or self-hate, or self-loathing, or upset with other people, or whatever might happen when we get sick. When we're quite sick, it's very hard to develop awareness and compassion. And that's why it's very important to have a spiritual practice when we're healthy enough to develop a strength of awareness and compassion, so that when we do have come into extreme situations, there's a certain amount of momentum, a certain amount of strength in those two things, so that we can call upon them in very trying and difficult situations. So, compassion and awareness. But sometimes, I believe, we can be so sick that it's very hard to muster up those kinds of things. And then, in my understanding, and I was so sick in my little cold, for at least a day of it, that I couldn't muster up anything. Except what I could do was, the image I had for myself was like I would surf with my illness. And what is surfing was, when I had enough presence of mind to practice, I would. And when I didn't have enough presence of mind, I'd be in kind of la la land or whatever, or just miserable. And I would, in a sense, just surrender to it. This is what's happening. It's hopeless. And I would just lay there. And I would be laying there shivering. I spent like 2 days just shivering. I couldn't believe I was capable of shivering for 2 whole days. And I just lay there shivering. My body would do all these weird things. And I thought it was kind of amazing to watch this body do these. I certainly not my body. I couldn't identify with my body. And I couldn't identify with my thoughts, because my thoughts were just doing whatever they wanted to do, and I didn't have no control over them. So who was I? Who am I? If I'm not my body, not my thoughts, not my emotions, who am I? Well, what I tried to... I don't know who I am, but... what it became in this practice of surfing was, when things were really difficult, I would try to surrender to that. Maybe surrender, I don't know if that's the right word, but I would just... I mean, I knew I wasn't dying. I would just let it be that way. I would just be someone who I didn't recognize. I would be someone who I didn't know who it was. I just kind of lay there in amazement, to whatever degree I could in my kind of la-la land. Amazed that I was in la-la land. Amazed that I, whatever. So this idea for me was important, was the idea of not fighting or resisting what was going on, but kind of giving into it, until there was enough presence of mind again to bring some kind of practice to it all. Well, that's my few thoughts I had. I didn't want to talk too long today. I thought it'd be more interesting to hear from some of you, your thoughts and comments. And I think some of you probably have much more wisdom around this issue than I do. Yes, Jonathan.
I had an injury once, and I found similarly that when I had sort of self-pitying or miserable thoughts, I became more in pain, and then sort of the cycle increased, and I understood. And I perhaps felt a little bit guilty when I'm like, no, I'm going to take control of my thoughts, and I don't want to feel self-pity, and I would feel better. But I felt, this is not mindfulness, this is something else, and I'm meant to be mindful. It sounds like you had a similar experience in sort of trying to step away from certain thoughts. I wondered how that fits in with the practice of mindfulness.
Oh, this is something I thought maybe bringing up as a topic someday. When I and maybe some other people teach mindfulness, We teach a practice which is simply to be aware of what's going on without changing it, without changing anything, just relying on the power of observation to be present for what's going on and not trying to change it or manipulate it. It's a very powerful practice to do that. And it's very, very useful. But some people will interpret that to be, that's all they're supposed to do, that's the only thing they're allowed to do in the spiritual life, is to just bring awareness, not try to change anything. And then you get silly. There's a time and a place for bringing very powerful mindfulness that doesn't try to change anything, just sees things as they are. If you really want to discover freedom, you have to develop that ability to be present for something without needing it to be different. But there are times with our common sense that's quite appropriate to change our state of mind, change our consciousness, or change. And you have to have some common sense about when it's useful to do it and when it's not useful to do it. And if you're sick, that seems like a great time to change your consciousness if you have the ability to do that. Doesn't, you know, I take aspirin when I get a headache sometimes. You know, I certainly can change my thoughts if that's, you know, that seems much less dramatic than taking an aspirin. So I think there's a place for it, and you don't have to feel like you know, you're doing some, you don't have kind of narrow kind of folk idea of what the only spiritual practices you're allowed to do. And if you have some other practices besides mindfulness, like a concentration practice, sometimes when you're sick, that's the time to do it. It can be very the deeper the samadhi, the deeper the concentration, the more healing tends to happen in the body. It's really phenomenal to be in a really powerful state of concentration, of samadhi, to feel the kind of, for lack of a better vocabulary, the healing energy kind of coursing through the body. It's phenomenally, it's kind of like when you're in a deep state of concentration, many of the natural processes of healing in the body can function most optimally. And so if a person has access to samadhi, and when they start getting sick or being sick, that's a great time to do it. And I would rely on that. And that's one of the things I do sometimes. If I start getting sick, I'll try to get into as deep of concentration as I can, as deeply relaxed as I can. Nowadays, my concentration isn't, as my samadhi isn't as strong as it is when I used to do a lot of meditation. So, you know, it used to be, if I did a lot of meditation, I could enter into samadhi much quicker. Now, you know, it takes more than just, I can't just sit down for half an hour now and enter the same very deep levels. It takes longer to build up to it. But now, when I was a monk, I could do it quite quickly. And when I was getting sick, that's what I would do. And sometimes it seemed that the samadhi would just, prevent the cold from getting any worse, or it would stop it in its tracks. There was once in the monastery where I had the hiccups. I had hiccups for 24 hours, except when I was sleeping, and except for when I was sitting in meditation posture. As soon as I got into this posture, it would stop. I would enter into a kind of, I was so meditating so much that just simply getting this posture would kind of drop me into a kind of mild, light samadhi. And as soon as I entered that kind of state of relaxation, the hiccups would stop. And then when the bell rang to end the meditation, did I answer your question okay? Yes?
I'd like to comment on the relationship between the mind meditation and the body. I'm a physician. As an oncologist, so I deal with people who are sick and dying. And that kind of balance between the power of the mind and the power of the body that you experience in microcosm and intuitiveness is, there is no universal dominance of one over the other. Ultimately, we shed minds so that I can have the dominance. But the thing that you mentioned is practicing some form of samadhi generation. I would say samadhi yoga. And if you don't do that, when you have the chance to learn, it's like swimming when the boat goes down in the middle of the Atlantic, you practice in the pool. But the guilt that people have when they encounter a moment that they can't just kind of, well, I'm a meditator, or I'm highly spiritual, and I can
like this, is when they find that their body has a power over their mind. Why is that so strange if you can believe that your mind is the power of your body?
So sometimes one has the upper hand, sometimes the other. I thought about that when I was sick, because I thought, when I was laying there kind of in my la-la land, I thought, if some emergency happened with my son, I think I could have mustered up a presence of mind to take care of the emergency. And it would have been an example of somehow that because it was so important, the mind would have taken precedent, the power of the mind. But, you know, there was no emergency. So given the fact there was no emergency, there wasn't a motivation somehow to really channel the mental power, which sometimes can be channeled. Yes. Yeah, please.
I'm actually new to this practice. My name's Missy, and I come from another spiritual tradition. Now, I had a bout of serious chronic illness for 2 years, coming from a relatively young and healthy age. And what I found is, because I had such despair and fear, it drove me to becoming spiritual and trying to sit and be aware. And I had two experiences. The first was, I really liked what you said about surrendering. The first was trying to surrender fear of the unknown, fear of permanent disability, and to really just get to a place where I could really just totally and completely accept and have compassion for my body and to stop trying to control the outcome. And then the second thing that I gained from this particular spiritual practice, which did include sitting, was a sense of imagery and trying to image the parts of me that were sick into a healthy place. And I really liked what you were talking about this focused concentration. And I was wondering how imagery is used in this particular spiritual practice, if and when it's appropriate.
Oh, sure, it's fine to do that. What's happened is that the American Vipassana movement has mostly been teaching Vipassana, this very, very, very specific practice of mindfulness. And sometimes we forget that the Buddhist tradition that it comes from, the Theravadan tradition, has a whole repertoire of practices under its belt. It's really a wide, wide tradition, and lots of different practices. It's just that this particular one is understood to be the one that can take you the furthest to liberation. So there's kind of been people have specialized it. You know, that's just bringing the most powerful practice back to America. And as it's being rooted here in America and finding a home here, many of the people are beginning to realize, oh, wait a minute, we have to also bring with us all these other practices that we've kind of forgotten about, that we ignored in our youthful enthusiasm. And there are, the Theravadan tradition has visualization practices, it has mantric practices, it has, all kinds of different practices, healing practices, that many of us don't even know so well because we were so narrowly focused. So that's kind of our shortcoming. We took one practice from Asia and brought it here, and now, because we only have one practice, we have to kind of reinvent the wheel. It would have been better if we brought the whole tradition over. But if you brought the whole tradition over, no one would have been interested in the practice. So, you know, it's we did what we did. Make sense? Peggy?
You talk about doing the concentration practice when you're sick, and I actually do the other. I learned it before I started sitting. I learned it when I had cancer. But it was so powerful that's what drew me to sitting. And then eventually, I was always back in kicking and screaming with Buddhism. But the practice was of sitting and being with the symptoms that were so difficult and so painful or very scary, the very thing that I didn't want to be with. And as I did that, what I discovered, you talk about the connection between mind and body, was that actually, and also compassion. I mean, I just want to say that was one of the things I had to learn. That was a major thing, a gift that I got, was compassion for myself and body. But even more was this gift that that my symptoms, my illness, actually was communicating with me, that if I listen, I have messages from the body that are very rich and helping and growing and expanding and meeting my needs that maybe I'm not aware of or not paying attention to. And that in that, the healing can happen on many different levels. And sometimes it's physical, sometimes it's not, sometimes it's emotional or spiritual. But that was that was an incredible learning for me. It's not about pushing. It isn't about pushing away or concentrating or getting rid of it. It was about actually staying there. Really go, actually meeting, going into the symptom. You're going as far in as I can go or the situation.
Fantastic. Thank you. Yes?
I want to talk about a different kind of sickness, which is stress. When I feel stress, I subconsciously tense certain muscles, and after a while they hurt. So I just wanted to see what you think, well, what kind of ways to prevent that or break that cycle.
So how to prevent getting stressed?
Well, I guess, or at least allowing it to manifest in physical discomfort.
Well, I think what Peggy said was a very powerful thing to do when there's physical tension in the body, to bring mindfulness to tension and simply feel it. Listen to it carefully, feel it, let it be there, give it space, don't resist it. And what my experience is when I do that, it tends to kind of like making space for tension to unravel. And as it unravels, sometimes I'll become aware of some of the causes of it, some of the fears or anxieties that might be the cause of it. Sometimes I might not in the moment, but it begins to unravel. So maybe because I meditate a lot, one of the most useful things I know for stress or tension is meditation itself. There are other things that can be done. But what you want to do ultimately with stress is not simply have some powerful or useful techniques of relaxation, because then you can just be in a cycle of getting tense, relaxing, getting tense, relaxing, getting your massage, getting tense, going the next day for a second massage, getting tense. And you're just kind of alleviating the symptoms, not understanding the cause of the stress. And that's where mindfulness becomes very important, is where we start bringing some mindfulness, either in meditation or in the day-to-day events, to start paying attention, what is actually that triggers the stress for us? Because it isn't very seldom that outside events cause stress. It has to do with our relationship to events. And so what is it? What is our relationship? What are we doing? How are we getting hooked? How are we resisting things? How are we being driven by things? How are we afraid of things? What are we doing that builds up the stress? And as we begin more carefully looking at the roots of the causes of stress, then we find we have more choice but not to get into those hooks. So if you can prevent it before it starts, you're much better off than, just fixing it each time it happens. Mira.
So I was wondering if you could help me reconcile two different things. So, like 11 years ago, I had a stroke at 24, and all of a sudden I was like, I lost a lot of what sort of made me me, and I really hated that. So I had this, basically. Vision. In other words, I didn't like where I was, so I said, I want to be right here. And that, I think, really helped me to recover. So it's sort of like, I didn't want to be with where I was. I was, moment with, the illness, but at the same time, there's part of me that was just sort of like, okay, I'm not here, I'm over there. I'm not sure how that's... I think that's actually useful for people to visualize, what's...
So have
where they want to be.
To have a goal.
Like,
yeah, there's nothing wrong with having goals. And again, a simplistic understanding of Buddhist teachings would be you're not supposed to have a goal at all. You're simply supposed to be present for what's happening and just accept that. because that's what the practice is. You know, and then if people extrapolate, that means everywhere in every situation I'm supposed to be doing that. But I think it's quite fine to have goals, and goals can be very can give us purpose and meaning and fuel us to kind of be engaged in our process of healing. But always with goals, it's important to understand, to be kind of wise around goals. So, for example, not to be to have aspirations, but not to have expectations. Expectations are, you're setting yourself up for disappointment. Aspirations can just fuel you and inspire you. Sometimes it's not possible to attain those goals. If our sense of identity and sense of personal self-worth is only tied in with the goal that we're going to attain, then you might be successful in attaining that goal, or you might not be. Maybe you'll have a second stroke or something else will happen. And part of the challenge, I think, part of the offering and the challenge, I guess, of Buddhist practice is to suggest that there is a sense of well-being that can be discovered that's not dependent on being anyone. And so there are plenty of people who go through some kind of chronic illness or injury or something, and they look back after a number of years and they're very grateful for the illness, because it forced them to reevaluate their priorities in their life and their self-identity and the kind of things that they really held on to as really important. And so suddenly their priorities and interests and the way they relate to the other people changes dramatically, because they couldn't, do whatever they kind of, they thought they could do earlier in life. So it's fine to have goals, but we need to have some wisdom around them, so that the goals aren't a condition for more disappointment. Amira.
It's funny because there really are no coincidences. As I was walking here today, I was realizing that, like, the first time in 5 weeks, I had energy. It was 7 o'clock, and I still had energy. Unfortunately, I was diagnosed with some food allergies, which side effects are fatigue and space weakness and all these different things. So it's been a real struggle. In the last 5 weeks, it's been very difficult. Start a new job, and fatigue and spaciness doesn't lead to high performance. So it's been really interesting, but it's nice to sit here today, because, like, I think if I look at the last 5 weeks, and I still have a long way to go on the journey, a full lifestyle change, but, I know initially, and I've had a lot of health problems, I know, like, what I clued into is how there's always that, like, not wanting to be in my body. If I look at, I went through that stage. And I think what's been interesting, because it kind of culminated today, was how it forced me to take care of myself, not just, in my own body, but I had to talk to my manager, I had to get the facilities that I needed, I had to tell him I can't travel this week. And I think just today has been a day where it's, it felt really good that I've been able to kind of set those limits and set those boundaries, and as difficult as it's been, it's been interesting to kind of have it all kind of come together.
Yeah, I had food allergies for about 7 years, so I understand some of the difficulties. So, last one, and then we'll stop.
I've thought a lot about sickness recently, in that when I grew up, I wasn't allowed to be sick, and so I hid illness in my family and took from my parents. And for a long time, when I would get sick, I would take all the medications and then take some Tylenols or Secadols or drugs or whatever, and I'd go to sleep for 24 hours. And wake up and hope to be well. And if I wasn't, I'd do it again. And this was how I dealt with illness. And so now, being clean and sober, it's a different awareness to actually get ill or something and have to ask for help. And that is the hardest thing for me. And I think it's interesting that one of my sons is probably the most dramatic. He has the most dramatic headache. And it's like a lesson for me.
Thank you. So may you all stay healthy and get healthy, and thank you all.